Hello everyone and welcome to another week at the Damage Report, another year at the Damage Report, another decade at the Damage Report. And I know what you're thinking, it's not actually the start of a new decade, but shut up, nobody cares about that. We do it in 10-year chunks, okay? And this is how we've decided to do it, mathematician. Anyway, no, I'm mad, I can't do the show, I'm kidding. Okay, so we do have a full show for you. In a little bit, TYT contributor and also of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm is gonna join us. We're gonna be breaking down a bunch of important news of the day, including fundraising totals coming out for a couple of the front runners in the Democratic primary. One candidate raised a bonkers amount of money. Spoiler alert, it's Klobuchar. But we've got a lot more for you too. The wine cave controversy remains. Why do young liberals dislike Buttigieg? We're gonna dive into it. And later on, we've got a really tragic death on New Year's Eve. Totally didn't need to happen. And news from around the world in meanwhile. But before we get to all of that, I do wanna start off with a little bit on climate change over here. We talk about climate change a lot on this channel. Generally, we're trying to take stock of what is happening in the here and now in different parts of our world. Occasionally, we look forward to what we can expect to happen if the climate crisis is allowed to continue unabated, or if we pursue certain strategies to mitigate some of the damage that might be done. But for right now, I wanna look back because I came across this article on Grist by Clayton Aldern. What Clayton did in this article was go through a number of different sources of data and summarize the last decade of climate change across a number of different axes. It's really fascinating information. I think there's a lot that we can learn from this, especially if you, like me, want to be able to influence people in the right direction as we go forward. You have to know what you're talking about. And so I wanna talk about some of what we know, including some of the challenges that remain. So first, atmospheric carbon dioxide parts per million. Take a look at this. It was very popular on my timeline on social media sites. Everyone was doing their 2010 and 2019 photos. Well, this is one that I and a lot of other people shared because despite the fact that many Americans still don't think that climate change is a thing and don't get how it would happen if it were a thing, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide continued to move up. And some of the limits that we would have expected decades ago that the Earth would never reach, that we have not seen on Earth since before humans were a species, are now the lows on any given year, and it continues to move up. And according to the best scientist predictions, we are getting very close in about 10 years of advancement in that to a point where we will not be able to stop more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of overall average warming around the world. So that's a reminder of the threat that we face. A reminder of the damage being done right now though comes in this next chart. So take a look at this. This is from NOAA data, and it looks at each year the different sorts of annual billion-dollar disasters. Now, not every one of these is caused by climate change. Not everyone can be said that it wouldn't have happened if not for climate change. But we know now where this story is going, and climate change is contributing to many of these. To the wildfires, obviously, we're plagued by those even right now in Australia, and California and other parts of America have faced severe ones as well. Severe storms, hurricanes happening where they're not supposed to be able to happen, outside of the times that they're supposed to happen, are now becoming more common and more dangerous. But while we generally talk about climate change from the point of view of heat, it can also lead to worsening storms in the winter as well. And so you're seeing those go up as well. So this data shows that, look, going back to 2010, it's not like we didn't have natural disasters. It's not like we didn't have natural disasters that caused a lot of damage. But the trend is that they are becoming more common. And so it begs the question, the inverse of the question that we always hear, which is, how are you gonna pay to deal with climate change? This chart is a reminder, how are you gonna pay if you don't deal with climate change? Because that is only going up and up and up. And we're still at the sort of easy part of the climate crisis. What we're looking ahead to in a couple of decades, to 30, 50, 100 years, is absolutely devastating. And that chart is gonna look quaint once we get to that point, unless we do what we need to do. So now, moving forward to a little bit of positive news, and that has to do with public opinion. So let's take a look at this. This is from Yale, their climate change communications program data. And you can see over 10 years, the percentage of the American public who believe that climate change is happening has been trending up. Not as much as I perhaps would want, but whereas 60% back in 2010 believe that it's happening, that's up now to 72%. And the percent who don't think it's happening at all is down to just 12%. That is still just impossible to understand, but it is at least going down. And that represents over the course of 10 years, about half of those remaining deniers have dropped out, almost. But let's go back to that because we also have to deal with, okay, you think it's happening. That's the first obstacle. The second obstacle is, do you believe that it is humans that are causing it? And that shows that, yes, again, we're moving in the right direction, but not quite as fast and not reaching the same levels, because one out of three Americans still think that we're not causing it, that it's just like solar flares or natural cycles of variation or Thor's breath, I don't know. They think something other than the fact that humanity has covered the globe and is emitting carbon in virtually everything we do at levels the Earth has never seen before. Those two things are not connected. I get that it's happening, but I don't think that we're causing it. It's mind blowing. But even there, the majority of Americans agree that it's happening and that we're causing it. The third tier, we don't have data on this right now, is do you believe that it's happening? Do you believe that we're causing it? Do you believe that we can stop it from happening? And that is really a question of political and economic will. And I believe that that is now where we've gotten to in terms of that's where we're fighting our battle. Most people, the people who are going to accept the science, they now do. The people who get that we're causing it, the vast majority of those now get it. Now it's, are we going to do what we need to do to the extent we need to do it and in the time that we have remaining? And so that's what we're fighting. And we should be glad that we've gotten to that point, but that is still a titanic fight that we're gonna have to have. And now we talk about what that fight is going to look like, because we have overall public opinion, and now we have that through the lens of partisanship. Let's take a look at this. So this is the divide between Democrats and Republicans on, do you worry a great deal about the quality of the environment? And the percentage of Democrats saying they worry a great deal has skyrocketed, a significant percentage gain from 47% of Democrats up to 65%. That is great. But for Republicans, fewer Republicans are worried about the environment now than in 2010. That is mind blowing. What have we been experiencing? Like, think about what that actually represents, because there is not a Republican in this country that doesn't get that we are facing horrific natural disasters. Whether you're on the coasts, whether you're in the interior, you're being hit by something. It may be fire, it may be water, I don't know, it may be wind, but it's something that's hitting you. So they get that. They've seen the headlines, yes. They, for the most part, only listen to Fox News, and so they've got this bubble, but it can't have, something must have gotten through in the past few years. And yet they're still not worried about it. What sort of bizarre, like self-sacrificing fatalism is that? That you see what's going on in the US, you see what's going on around the world, but who really worries about that stuff? I mean, that is insane. And that, look, I'm not saying that we can turn around all those people, but we gotta get some of those people, unfortunately, because it's not just that we have to pull over some of the Republicans. There are still quite a few elected Democrats that don't get it on climate change. And so as we go into 2020, we have a great opportunity now, not just to take back power in some abstract sense, but to take it back for a reason, for the reason, which is to deal with this climate crisis. And we're not already through the primaries, you know, on the presidential side, but also perhaps more importantly on the congressional side. We can't just win in a partisan sense in 2020. We have to win now so that we have the right candidates when we win in the later part of this year. So engage in those fights now, because this battle, like, it's difficult for any one individual person to make a big difference, although Greta shows that that's even possible too. We have to choose the right people, and that's where your vote and your voice really counts. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Ryan Grimm's gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
One of the standout moments from the last Democratic debate was the wine cave controversy and the focus that it put on fundraising in this primary, both for Pete Buttigieg, but for other candidates as well. Well, now in the news cycle, we have Q4 numbers. We're gonna dive into those numbers a little bit later on. But for Pete Buttigieg, has he really moved past this wine cave controversy? Well, we're joined now on the show by Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept, who recently wrote about the wine cave and what people are getting wrong about the controversy for The Intercept. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back here.
Good to have you here. So we have a lot that we're gonna be talking about on the show today, but let's start off with the wine cave. And so you wrote up some of what you feel like people were getting wrong in this discussion initially. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I feel like in some important ways, he'll never move past the wine cave. Because it marks, you know, his view of how politics ought to be conducted in 2020 and going forward. And I think that the biggest thing that people got wrong about this, and it's hard to actually gauge that because people got so many things wrong about it. But to me, the biggest one is about access to politicians. Jane Lynch, for instance, went on Twitter and said, "Look, billionaires should have just as much right to participate in the democratic process as the plumber in my bathroom." Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, everybody should agree with that. They should have just as much right, and that right is one vote at the ballot box. We're an equal opportunity country. The difference here is that the billionaire has the opportunity to be with the candidate in the wine cave, pressing his agenda on that candidate, where the plumber does not have access to that wine cave unless a pipe breaks. The waitress doesn't have access to that wine cave unless somebody's $900 a bottle glass of wine needs to be refilled. Mm-hmm. And often the billionaire will send a lobbyist in there. The billionaire doesn't actually want to be in the wine cave himself. And so you had the spectacle of a lobbyist taking to the pages of the Washington Post to say that, well, not everybody in there were billionaires. Some of us just lobbyists for the healthcare industry. And so, yes, Jane Lynch, if a billionaire wants to cut a check to even the Bernie Sanders campaign, as long as he's not a fossil fuel executive or a registered lobbyist, it's not obvious that Sanders would say no to that.
Yeah.
Now if the billionaire, happens to be himself personally toxic, then yeah, he'd probably say, I'm not taking Jeff Bezos's, $2,800. But in general, your run of the mill everyday billionaire is welcome to go on to Act Blue and make, whatever legal contribution that they feel like making to whatever candidate they want to make it to. What Sanders and Warren are saying is that you don't have the opportunity to buy access, private access to the candidate, which you will use to press the agenda that you have. And the agenda that you have is a billionaire's agenda.
And the amazing thing, and I'll just say, like I always say, I always preface my criticisms of her by saying I love Jane Lynch and everything she's been in. But the saying they should have the same access that a plumber does sort of, to me, implies like that the wine cave finally evens the playing field, as if billionaires didn't already have advantages in literally every other aspect of politics. I mean, their companies are represented by trade groups that have insane access to all of these politicians. They can get on the phone and talk to the candidate individually. I think it was Leon Cooperman when he was having an issue with Elizabeth Warren a couple months ago. He got brought on TV to talk about it so many times just because he didn't like a candidate. I don't like a ton of candidates. They're not putting me on MSNBC about it. So even without the wine cave, they already have an insanely outsized influence.
Right, but they feel under siege, and I mean, frankly, in a lot of ways, they should, because they are the subject of public opprobrium. People are angry at billionaires, and so they have kind of transformed that feeling into one of marginalization, and they have even been deploying terminology along those lines. In the Washington Post op-ed by the healthcare executive, he referred to quote unquote people of means when he said, yes, it's true that there were people of means at this event. People of means. And he didn't just pull that out of nowhere. Howard Schultz specifically said in a CNN interview, speaking of access to the political process, the guy has really no like obvious right to have a CNN town hall. He just gets one because he's a billionaire.
Yeah.
And in that town hall, he said that he thought it was disparaging and discriminatory to refer to rich people, and even to refer to billionaires, which is just a factual kind of assertion. Like, you have $1 billion, you're a billionaire. Mm-hmm. They find that to be have come with a stigma. Of course, not among the fellow rich. There, if you're denied your billionaire status, they take umbrage. Then he said, therefore, we should be addressed as people of means. And so that language was then appropriated by this healthcare executive in his Washington Post op-ed, who said he himself, in fact, though, was not a millionaire or a billionaire. At The Intercept, we very quickly fact-checked that assertion because property records are public. Found that he's got at least $2 million of equity in just in his home.
Yeah.
You know, his IRAs and his 401ks and his other property are not public record, but just on his primary residence in San Francisco alone, he's a millionaire.
Yeah.
And the Washington Post had to to put up a kind of awkward correction. He is a millionaire. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about Buttigieg. I saw Politico had an article. It was Why Pete Buttigieg Enrages the Young Left. And you can see the headline there and you can read it for yourself. And look, I think that it's fair to question. Like, there certainly are a lot of young left, especially online people that do have a particular issue with him. I consider myself one of those. And so I was interested to see, was Politico going to be able to sort of accurately understand what the issues with Pete Buttigieg are? And I'm not sure how well they did. I want to read just a couple of quick excerpts and then I want your opinion. So they say, the unspoken truth about the furor Buttigieg arouses is that his success threatens a core belief of young progressives, that their ideology owns the future, and that the rise of millennials in a democratic politics is going to bring an inevitable demographic triumph for the party's far left wing. In the eyes of radicalized young leftists, Buttigieg isn't just an ideological foe, he's worse than that. He's a square. And they talk about how he's considered like a millennial traitor or something like that. I mean, what do you think about Politico and outside of people on the left, their ability to understand the criticisms that he's facing?
Well, it's painful. Speaking of young progressives, here's one here who's home with the flu. So it's painful for me to acknowledge, but I am probably not one of those young progressives that Politico would be talking about. I'm in my 40s now, but I think they kind of missed what's going on here, because I think it's a lot simpler. And a lot of it just has to do with his success in the polls. If he continued to hang around 4 or 5% and continued talking about the things that he talked about early in the campaign, structural Supreme Court reform, abolishing the filibuster, abolishing Electoral College, supporting Medicare for all, nobody would have had any problem with him, and you wouldn't have needed all of these complicated think pieces to get to it. But as he, as he's rising in the polls, then he becomes a serious threat. And so I think for that significant reason, a lot of young progressives kind of started going after him. And if he had stuck to a lot of the things that he was saying early in the campaign, he's for Medicare for all, for criminal justice reform, mm-hmm. For all these structural reforms, then the rise in the polls wouldn't alone have been enough to draw the ire of progressives. All the personality quirks aside, you had a combination of him attacking all of these progressive ideas very aggressively. See you, Virginia. And so, it just stands to reason that progressives would, turn on somebody who's attacking progressive ideas.
And one thing that, I don't know if it's a willful omission, but Pete Buttigieg over the past couple of months, a lot of the harshest questioning that he's faced is his fundraising. And so I agree. I think that had he not risen in the polls, he wouldn't have gotten much negative attention necessarily. But once you rise, then as someone who doesn't support that candidate, you have to start to see, what did they say to get that rise? Who were they supported by financially and in the media? And that is where the criticism comes from. And I think a lot of these analyses don't want to delve into harsh questions about his fundraising, his often extremely dismissive responses to questions about that fundraising, the fact that many non-supporters of Pete Buttigieg believe that the media has given him effectively a pass. Like, these are all things that I think they don't necessarily want to get too into, because it questions, well, them for one thing, but also the general fundraising strategy of many candidates.
Yeah, and I think the media misunderstands a lot of it, and particularly on Medicare for All, for instance. The media treats Medicare for All kind of as a proxy of how progressive you are, but to millions of people, it's a very serious, timely, and urgent issue as well. I mean, actually take Virginia, who was just here a second ago, and I was tweeting about this in the last day or two. You know, she woke up on January 1st with a fever. Yeah. And so because her twin sister had already had the flu, we immediately took her down the street to the CVS MinuteClinic, which owns Aetna, which is our insurance provider. It's absurd that the provider and the insurer are in the same company. Mm. And of course, they also own the pharmacy. They prescribe Tamiflu, and we go over, and they want $198 for this Tamiflu, because the new deductibles kick in. We have a $6,000 deductible, which of course we haven't met because it's January 1st.
Yeah.
In order to get her twins Tamiflu, it was $10 last week for the copay. And so so much of our healthcare system is this barbaric lottery. What rational sense does it make? You know, did she make a mistake by waiting until January 1st to present her fever? If she'd have done it on December 31st, it would have been $188 cheaper. And so, you know, that's not a unique situation. That happens to millions of people every day around this country that are interacting with this healthcare system. And then to see Buttigieg out there saying, "Well, I trust you to make your own healthcare decisions," clashes so sharply with what he said in the beginning of the campaign, which is that he supports Medicare for All. And I think people get that it was a calculated strategy, that, you know, he needed a small dollar army, he needed a rationale for his candidacy early on in the campaign, and so he presented himself as this kind of insurgent progressive candidate who didn't have the baggage of being a 78-year-old Democratic socialist. And so as a result of that, kind of he picked up enough energy to make himself a viable candidate, even though he was just the mayor of South Bend. If he'd have tried to present himself as just another centrist, he had all of these other folks to compete with. But then when it was clear that he wasn't going to win on the progressive side, and it was, and I'm sure he was clear about that from the beginning, then he switches and jumps over into the into the moderate lane. And he did this in full view of people who are aware of what's going on, to then be surprised that people would take some umbrage at that kind of blatant politicking is a little bit naive on the part of the media.
I agree. Okay, we're going to take a short break, but we're going to stick around, because Ryan's going to join us on the other side. More news to get to after this.
This is a stunning number from Bernie Sanders. Again, $34.5 million.
There you have MJ Lee on CNN revealing that at least of the candidates who've revealed their Q4 fundraising dollars, Bernie Sanders has shattered everything. Over $34 million raised. Ryan Grimm joins us once again, contributor to TYT and also of The Intercept. What do you think about this result? Were you predicting anything like this?
Well, you know, if you're on his emails, as I assume you are as well, you know, you've seen kind of one of the biggest rampings up towards the end of a quarter that they've probably ever done, and in a much more, you know, sophisticated way than they've done before. You know, he to a significant degree, Sanders has the same team doing his email fundraising that he had in 2015 and 2016, and they are, you know, I think inarguably the best in politics at doing this. And so all of the things that they learned in 2016, they're now bringing to bear in 2019 and 2020. And so, you know, they had a different approach for different types of donors. You know, they were reaching out to people who And people were forwarding me the different emails that they were getting. If you had given several contributions of $10, $20, but at one point you gave $250, they would reach out to you with an automated email that looked kind of personalized. It said, look, you know, the biggest contribution you ever gave was $250. Our average donation is down to $14. That's great. We love that we have so many small dollar givers, but we also need to compete against people who are bringing in $2,800 a pop. And so can you give us $250 again, like you did last time? Mm-hmm. People who had never given, they were reaching out and saying, you know, we know you've never given before, but could you, you know, can you give $2.70 just to get going? You know, they brought in 300,000 new donors in this quarter. They brought in 40,000 brand new donors on the last day, December 31st, wow. A single day. 40,000 new, trying to hit this 5 million number, which, some of the people doing the email fundraising were even on the Howard Dean campaign, which kind of pioneered this idea of setting these difficult to reach goals. Because a lot of campaigns in the past would set a goal that they knew that they were going to hit, so then they could celebrate hitting the goal they knew they were going to hit. Mm-hmm. What Dean did differently is he put one, he wasn't sure if he was going to hit it, and trusted in his people and his supporters to hit it. So they put out this 5 million donor number, and that knowing they could fail. And people stepped up and gave big time. So I wasn't sure exactly what the number was going to look like, but I knew that they had kind of pulled out all the stops to make it happen. And it, you know, to get 300,000 new donors shows that the idea that Sanders' base can't be expanded, you know, that's kind of the knock on him. That yes, he's got his vibrant support, but it, you know, there's a ceiling. You know, it shows that you know there are new people out there that can be activated.
And I mean, that's 5 million overall. No one else, as far as we know, has reached 3 million. We do know that some other candidates have done pretty well. You know, Buttigieg raised 24.7 million, that is a lot. Andrew Yang raised 16.5 million, which is, I don't think, mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting that. I don't know if anyone was.
He wasn't. You know, he was expecting about 12 million, mm-hmm. it sounds like.
It would have been pretty amazing for him even at 12.
Yeah, and I think his supporters, you know, recognized that there was a good chance that he won't make the January debates, and wanted to do everything they possibly could to try to forestall that.
Yeah. So I do want to touch on one other aspect of this, and let me know if you think that we're splitting hairs here. But so a lot of people have been spreading around these dueling headlines from the New York Times about the results that were revealed today. So the first is for Bernie Sanders. It's Bernie Sanders says he raised $34.5 million in the fourth quarter. Mr. Sanders' total is the largest three-month haul disclosed by any Democratic candidate so far, but he trailed President Trump, whose campaign reportedly raised $46 million in the quarter. And then you contrast that with the Pete Buttigieg one. Pete Buttigieg's campaign says it raised $24.7 million. Mr. Buttigieg, who appears in strong position in Iowa with a month until the caucuses, continues to show fundraising strength. So, but if Sanders is trailing Trump, well, then Buttigieg is trailing him by a lot more. And so I think that that's a weird way to present those same facts.
Right. Another way to present it would be, you know, Buttigieg raised half of what Trump raised, or Trump crushed Buttigieg, or Sanders was the closest to matching Trump, even given the size of the Democratic field. So I think you're right. It's not something I'd kind of storm the Bastille over, but it certainly is indicative of a pattern of when there's a negative story on Sanders, it's on the front page. If there's positive news, they figure out a way to get a butt in there.
Yeah.
And for the Buttigieg, on the other hand, positive news goes on the front page, and you know there really aren't many efforts made to kind of discount it in any way, and which isn't kind of fair to the reader, because Buttigieg would have to win a general election if he won the nomination, and so it is fair to compare what he raised to his opponent in the general election.
Yeah. So let's turn to one other big story in the Democratic primary this morning. Julian Castro announced this morning that he would be dropping out of the 2020 Democratic primary. We've got a little bit of the video that he posted announcing this.
It's time for the Democratic Party to change the way that we do our presidential nominating process.
I'm so proud of the campaign we've run together. We've shaped the conversation on so many important issues in this race, stood up for the most vulnerable people, and given a voice to those who are often forgotten. But with only a month until the Iowa caucuses, And given the circumstances of this campaign season, I've determined that it simply isn't our time. So today, it's with a heavy heart and with profound gratitude that I will suspend my campaign for president.
So Ryan, I saw in the wake of this announcement that pretty much everyone had something nice to say about Julian Castro. I mean, there are a few people who entered this race and have done perhaps lasting damage to their reputations, but it doesn't appear at this point that Julian Castro is one of those people.
No, and interestingly, he seems to see a path on the progressive side for him in the future. You know, he was kind of always associated with more of the Clinton wing of the party, so, you know, served in the Clinton administration, in fact, in the Obama administration, but associated with the kind of the Clinton wing.
Yeah.
But really kind of broke out as a progressive in this campaign. And what he might be looking ahead at is that, you know, both Sanders and Warren are in their 70s. And, you know, Ocasio-Cortez would be technically eligible to run for president in 2024, but that, you know, it's not clear that that's where that's headed just yet. And so after that, you know, who are the kind of, you know, people to carry the progressive mantle forward that have, you know, national name ID, which this presidential campaign showed is extraordinarily important for, you know, to win the nomination. You know, it's going to be extremely hard for governors, for instance, to rise to the presidency going forward unless they do something about the process that they're using. And so Castro could say, you know what, there's nobody else in the progressive lane. So if I kind of make some of the same moves that Tulsi made in 2016, you know, bashing the DNC, you know, and kind of throwing red meat to the left, maybe that's enough to get me taken seriously enough by progressives that I could be kind of eligible for that vote in 4 years from now or 8 years from now.
So look, you've got a lot of experience. You've seen a lot of these campaigns, but also what people have done going out of the campaigns. If let's say Castro agrees with you and that is what he wants to do over the next 4 years or so, or a little bit more, what does he do? How does he spend that time?
Well, the first thing he does is either endorses a progressive candidate. Sanders would be his, the kind of strongest move if he's really going for it, or endorses a Warren and gets in the ground and tries to earn chits that way. Tries to earn the confidence of people by taking a real risk, because you're now taking on your party establishment. And otherwise, you kind of speak out against the party establishment in key moments. That would be the kind of way that you would set yourself up for that sort of thing.
So let me ask you one other question. And look, I think that he did a lot right, especially if the goal was not necessarily to win this time, but to generate a sort of new veneer of his sort of who he is. But why do you think that while we've seen a few candidates really right, like Warren certainly had her surge, Buttigieg popped up too, Andrew Yang has gotten quite a following. Why do you think that Castro wasn't one of those candidates this time around?
Well, he kind of got boxed out in a couple of different corners. So, you know, he wasn't, you know, with both Warren and Sanders on the left, you know, there's very little room over there, as well as, you know, Yang and Tulsi taking, you know, a non-trivial chunk from, you know, if you combine them 6-8 points, you know, that ends up mattering. So then after that, you've got, you know, the possibility of winning on the moderate side, but he was, you know, too many people were angry at him for coming after Joe Biden, and he was kind of behaving in kind of too progressive a way to be able to win that that moderate those moderate votes, which ended up then kind of going to Buttigieg instead. And so once that happened, there was really no room for him or for people like, you know, Cory Booker as well.
Yeah. Well, he ran a good campaign. It seems like he's one of the few who's leaving the campaign with a better reputation than he entered. So good job by Julian Castro there. Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept, thank you as always for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. New Year's Eve is supposed to be a time of celebration, but for one community in Texas, it became a tragedy of the worst kind when a woman died under horrible circumstances. Authorities told ABC 13 that this woman, identified as Philippa Ashford, was standing at the end of the driveway while family and friends in the cul-de-sac were shooting off fireworks when she suddenly clutched her body and said, "I think I've been shot." She collapsed to the ground and died. According to a sergeant with the Harris County Sheriff's Office, he says, "At this point, from our witnesses and seeing at the scene, we believe this may very well be the case of celebratory gunfire somewhere else in the neighborhood. No indication a family member or anyone else in the cul-de-sac was discharging a firearm." And that is easy to understand, because if you're doing that thing, and I'll get into that tradition in a second, you don't generally do it at waist level or something right in the area. But hypothetically, in some parts of the country, and Texas is one of those parts, it's a thing where when you are celebrating on certain holidays, you just shoot a gun in the air. And you forget for a second that it's a deadly weapon, and that bullets that go up eventually come down. And there's a lot of empty space, but there's also a lot of people in some areas, and Houston is certainly one of those areas, and she died. Now, more from Sergeant Ben Beale. He says, "I don't know you can even figure what the odds are. You've got the family together, celebrating the new year, and now the matriarch of the family is deceased." And officials apparently have gone house to house looking for shell casings and talking to residents in an effort to identify the origin of the gunshot. Good luck with that, because the very nature of this crime is you're never gonna find the person, and the person is never even going to know that because they wanted to celebrate a little bit, someone died. They shot a bullet in the air, it killed someone, and they will probably never know. Even if they see this news, and even if they live in that area, the very fact that multiple people would have done this around the same time, they will never know that they were responsible. And it reminds me of, you know, one of those hypothetical games that you play where it's like, if you could get $1 million, but in getting it, somewhere in the world, someone would die. Would you do it? With the idea being, well, it's a huge gain, and you'll never know the person who died. Would you be willing to do that to a person that you'll never know? So this is like that game, except the gain is nothing. You shoot a bullet in the air, and you feel cool for a second or whatever, and the cost is the same, that someone has to die. And I've spent New Year's in Texas, so I've seen this happen. I know that it's a traditional thing, and that you're not supposed to attack traditions, even if you think that they're stupid, but this is stupid. It's still a gun when you fire it on New Year's or on the 4th of July or on Christmas or God knows what. It doesn't suddenly become anything other than a deadly weapon just because fireworks are also going off and because you've had a couple of beers and because you're feeling good. But it is a part of our culture that we think, oh, sure, this thing is a weapon, but isn't it fun sometimes? Isn't it a cool hobby? Isn't it fun to collect them? Isn't it fun to go somewhere and shoot them? And so we normalize the casual use of things that are designed purely to kill things. And it might be extremely rare that something like this happens. Maybe this is the only one this year or this decade or in the last 50 years. But is any amount of celebratory gunfire worth this woman dying? And let's put up a picture of her, because people in her community have been talking a lot about how amazing she was, the great work she did as a crisis psychiatric nurse for more than 15 years. She was a leader in the community, and she's dead for nothing. If you never had a single person in Texas or anywhere shoot their gun to celebrate, they would be just fine. But if they keep on doing that, maybe every once in a while someone like Philip Ashford has to die. This is just a small part of the huge issue we have culturally with guns, but it's one that would be so easy to change, and I really hope that people do that. Okay, one more break, stick around. And now it's time for news from around the world, and meanwhile in. Meanwhile, in Vatican City, the Pope slapped a woman. You don't expect to say that ever, but here's the video, let's see. Okay, so it wasn't across the face or anything, but the Pope purposefully striking anyone, it seems weird, right? Like, I'm not naive, I'm not saying that like religious people don't do horrific, terrible things, or that his church in particular hasn't done lots of horrible things. But you don't expect to see him do it personally, right? And yes, she's grabbing on his arm, okay? And if you're the Pope, I imagine you're probably worried about being assassinated every second of every day. But he looked at her, She didn't have a flamethrower in her hand or anything. She was just pulling on his hand. Don't slap on the woman. And so thankfully he did respond. He did respond to this, saying, "So many times we lose patience, even me, and I apologize for yesterday's bad example. That's not good enough," but he does go on. He says, "All violence inflicted on women is a desecration of God. How often is a woman's body sacrificed on the profane altar of advertising, profit, pornography?" He said, adding that the female body must be freed from consumerism. It must be respected and honored. He lost me a little bit with some of the stuff that seems consensual that he just has a problem with. But yes, there is a lot of violence against women. And to put what he did in that context, even if I disagree with a lot of what he said, that is a good sort of apology, that he's not trying to like slap away concerns, that he's acknowledging that this is violence. It was a violent act. He goes on to say, "Despite creating life, women are continually offended, beaten, raped, forced into prostitution, and made to have abortions. We can understand our level of humanity by the way we treat a woman's body." Again, there's a little bit of stuff in there that we're gonna have some fundamental disagreements about what a woman should be able to consent to doing. But yes, that's a good apology. You got, like, if you're the Pope, we get to have pretty high expectations of your behavior. Don't slap anyone. Like, I know you're afraid that they're gonna have a knife or a gun. I would be terrified of that too if I was 1/10 as influential or powerful as you. But there's a lot of eyes on you, so take it easy, Pope. Meanwhile, in Australia, the fires have continued. We've checked in virtually with every Meanwhile In for the last couple of months, it feels like, and they're really bad still. Over 200 fires. We've got an area the size of Belgium that has already burned, more than 11 people dead. And you've probably seen the headlines of coastal communities, villages having to be, like, boats have come in to get people out of the area because it's so dangerous. But it has also been very dangerous for animals. So we wanted to check in once again with the situation for a number of different animal species. So apparently, we've got an Australian zookeeper who took home monkeys, pandas, and a tiger in order to keep them safe. So that's a big risk, taking a tiger home. But some people who have the ability are trying to get animals out of the way. But those are the animals that are in zoos and are relatively easy to get to. Overall, though, it's been really bad for animals. Ecologists from the University of Sydney now estimate 480 million mammals, birds, and reptiles have been lost just since September. That's a few months. That figure is likely to soar following the devastating fires which have ripped through Victoria and New South Wales south coast over the past couple of days. So that's before some of the most recent fires. Almost a half a billion animals of different species. And as we alluded to earlier, koalas have been amongst the hardest hit because they're very slow moving and literally the food they eat is highly flammable. Now, we also have a couple of videos, just we want you, this to be real for you. So here's a bit of some kangaroos who are fleeing the fires. You can see a gigantic pack, I don't know the real word, but a gigantic pack of kangaroos that are fleeing. The air is filled with smoke. And this is not as hard to watch as some of the koala footage we've shown you from Australia recently, but I'm not a koala expert, but I have been told that they're very hesitant to approach humans in general. That now has apparently changed because they're going up to humans to be saved, to be given water, as you'll see in this video.
That is genuinely.
Very thirsty boy.
Poor little thing. Oops, sorry.
That thankfully is a koala that has so far survived, but they are apparently in such dire straits that they are running up to humans, including bicyclists, because they believe that they might be saved, that there might be water available for them. Now, we've given you information in the past about a few different charities that you can participate in if you want to help out some of the people who've been devastated by this fire, also the animals that have been devastated. Going forward, it is going to be very interesting to see if the Australian government, which has been hesitant so far to acknowledge any sort of change to their reliance on coal, the harvesting of certain types of trees, there's going to be a lot of pressure on them after this, once people have gotten past the worst of the emergency and can take stock of what's left. Okay, thank you everyone for joining us for this episode. We had more we wanted to get to, but unfortunately we didn't have time. Tomorrow on the show, we are gonna have Brett Ehrlich, he's gonna join us. We're gonna break down a lot, but in particular, I wanna talk about former war criminal, now conservative influencer, Edward Gallagher. We're gonna show you the latest in right-wing grift. Thank you for joining us, we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.